From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nnamdi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist with the Current newspapers. Later in the broadcast, we'll be joined by Chris Van Hollen. He is a U.S. Senator for Maryland. Joining us now in studio is Patrick Mera. He is the executive director of the D.C. Republican Party. Patrick Mera, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kojo, especially on the Friday Politics Hour.
Tom Sherwood, good to
see you.
These are words you will soon regret, no doubt. If you have questions,
we'll fix that with the first question.
If you have questions or comments for Patrick Mera, you can call now 800-433-8850 or send email to kojo@wamu.org. Shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show or go to our website, kojoshow.org, where you can watch the live video stream of the broadcast, ask a question or make a comment there. President Donald Trump's limo, Tom Sherwood, is bearing D.C. taxation without representation license plates when he rolled up to Philadelphia earlier this week. That was taken note of. Do you think this is something that he's doing deliberately or that nobody noticed?
I think the latter.
and
maybe Patrick will know something about this. You know, the tag taxation without representation is on the license tag because of, I can't remember her name, and Mark Plotkin,
the
analyst, and it's been on and off. It's been up and down more times than a yo-yo in terms of the president's using it.
Yes.
I think it's an oversight on the Trump's policy. I don't think he has a policy. Somebody in the White House will probably see this news and take it off.
He has said in the past he has no position on D.C. statehood at this point. Here's Patrick Mera.
But it should be noted that Mike Pence, when he was in the U.S. House of Representatives, did support voting rights and even made statements. At least, I don't know if live, but at least they were submitted to the Congressional Record in support of voting rights for D.C. So this is a positive development.
It's entirely possible that this is a conscious development in this situation.
I just can't buy that conscious word.
We'll have to see.
It's a process. There's a zillion things. There are a billion balls in the air with the new Trump administration. This is one little one.
We'll have to see what happens in the future. In the meantime, there's a proposal by the Ward 7 council member in the District of Columbia, former Mayor Vincent Gray, to double the salaries of some police officers. The police department in Washington, D.C. has been seeing a lot of early retirements. They would like to get to 4,200 full-time officers, but there are fewer than 3,800. Mr. Gray says that if these officers agree not to retire and stay on for another 5 years, in the fifth year of their service, their salaries would be double. He feels that's the kind of incentive that they would go for. What do you say, Tom Schultz?
Well, the public policy aspect is that we are losing police officers faster than we can hire them and train them to take the jobs. The politics of this is that the 2018 mayor's race is already underway. Vince Gray has said on this program that he will look at possibly running for mayor, but he's going to do the best job he can to represent Ward 7. Ward 7 has a horrific crime problem. He believes there's not enough police there. And so he wants to do a dramatic thing to increase police by this additional money in the fifth year if they stay, like doubling their salary. This is a significant issue for Mayor Bowser, crime, and he's going to keep pushing at this all along.
What do you say, Patrick Mera?
Sure. Well, I mean, I've done a many, many ride-alongs, particularly in districts 7 and 6, and one of the things that always comes up with an officer 9 times out of 10 is that...
So when you recruit Tom and Kojo to become police officers, I bet that's what you're going to say.
Well, one of the things that comes up when you're doing a ride-along with a police officer is that often they say, oh, I'm getting out of here, you know, in a few years, 5 years. And the interesting thing is I don't know if the doubling of the salary is the right number. I mean, I've just basically read the news on this. Certainly something needs to be done to retain officers. It actually saves money in the long run if you're able to retain highly qualified officers. And this seems to be an ongoing problem with the police department, is that we just seem to lose officers so quickly.
Part of the issue is that it's very attractive to retire as a police officer. I was speaking to a police officer. She was telling me how she's going to be leaving the force next summer, this coming summer. And I said, well, good, you'll get 50% of your salary. She said, no, I think it's 75%. So if you stay on after you are eligible to retire, you're basically working for 25% of your salary because you get 75 automatically. And so it's a real issue. The suburban police forces have the same issue of paying officers. But I think at least what Vince Gray's proposal will do will make the mayor and the council members address what has been for a long time now a serious issue of too many officers leaving the force.
And an issue that might become even more serious now because, as Petula Dvorak said in her column in the Washington Post today, something we've been discussing here on the show over the past couple of days, is that increasing demonstrations in Washington might be becoming the new normal. And if that is indeed the case, then the District of Columbia will probably need more police officers to handle the situation. And it reminds one that at the inauguration demonstration that were held during the course of the past week, there were over 200 people arrested, and among those people were 5 journalists. I don't know how these days police make the distinction between who is a journalist and who says they're a journalist and who may not be a journalist.
Well, there are credentials.
Well, in some cases they are, but some independent journalists may not have the same kinds of credentials.
Well, maybe this is something that President Trump will do, you know, help the city finance some new police officers. Was it Richard Nixon who boosted the force up to like 5,000 officers when he ran against crime issues and things like that? And then the city's force has slowly gone down. 4,200 is the target number, but again, we're just under 3,800, so there's an issue to do this. Can I ask Patrick a political question about President
Trump? Not before you respond to the question of the 5 reporters being arrested and whether or not this might place the District of Columbia in a difficult situation. One remembers when we had the demonstrations against the IMF some years ago, and the city ended up paying a lot of money for people they arrested.
Yes, particularly at Pershing Park, where they just rounded up any person who was breathing and they arrested them and put them in handcuffs. They didn't do that this time. They corralled people who were in the zone where there was violence, where windows were being broken, where there was fear of the violence getting out of hand. And they detained people. And then some of the journalists ended up being arrested. I do not know if they had the credential you're supposed to have.
Well, they were charged with felonies, that's for sure.
I think they were the police department and the prosecutors were trying to have a show of force so it wouldn't get out of hand. If anybody is in fact prosecuted who is a journalist and who's not on videotape actually doing something, I don't think they'll face charges at all. The issue is, how can we better recognize, and there is one proposal that there be a media identification card for the District of Columbia, but who gets it? I mean, if you're a blogger, do you get it? Who knows?
Precisely.
Any person in America today is a journalist if he or she decides she wants to be one. And so I don't quite know how this is going to be done. There's no allegation that the police were abusive or
rough to anybody. No hog-tying this time around.
Right, no hog-tying this time, but they did detain people, and I think that's an issue that they'll have to work out some more.
Now your question for Patrick Mayer.
Well, now my question
is
called off my phone.
That's what I was relying on.
It's going to be a good one because he needs the phone.
Well, we're talking about President Trump taking over. We're talking about the license tag. We're talking about what he'll do, and we'll get to sanctuary cities and all that. But I want to quote from a Washington Post story from January the 13th, and I'm going to read 2 quick paragraphs. Mm-hmm. Quote, "We're going to make D.C. great again," said Patrick Meyer, leader of the district's Republican Party, who after 8 years... And when I've lost it again, my phone would not let me keep it on the screen. And maybe it doesn't like the quote enough to keep it on the screen.
Paper. Try paper.
After 8 years, a Democratic president found himself experiencing an unfamiliar sense of joy when Trump won. And you said you didn't even go out for a couple of weeks and tell people that you were so excited Trump won. Are you still excited Donald Trump is your president?
So I was, admittedly.
You're already waffling. That would be a yes or a no.
You're making me nervous. I was excited after the election, but the issue that, I mean, I talked to the writer there, I talked to Paul Schwartzman quite extensively, probably about 50 minutes for that article, and...
It's the media's fault you were quoted this way?
No, I don't. I'm a Republican in D.C. The last thing I can blame is the media.
Talking to them.
Oh, sure.
I want to hear your answer.
You know, absolutely. But look, you know, Donald, I'm
the executive. I'll just leave the room at this point. I'm the run the show.
Yeah, lots of
stuff. Arthur, are you happy Donald Trump is going to... is your president?
Yeah, look, I'm executive director of the D.C. Republican Party. I'm happy. I mean, what else can I say?
What do you want the president to do for to the city as opposed to the city?
Sure. Well, I mean, if we look at the previous 8 years, and this is, you know, this has been a problem for 40 years. It seems we've always been in a bargaining chip, district residents. So the problem of D.C. being a bargaining chip has been an ongoing problem, a bipartisan local problem, for at least 40 years. So, for example, when President Obama really set the most recent precedent of trading abortion to the Speaker of the House, you know, that angered a lot of people in D.C.
And he apologized later for doing that.
Yeah, sure, you can.
But he did it.
sorry about that. But it still happened. And so, and that's the most recent precedent coming from the president of the United States. And frankly, that's probably the biggest things that he weighed in on as president of the United States.
Okay, but we're in 2017 now, I think. Is that the year? I have to remember. All right. Your Republican Congress wants to weaken the city's gun laws. Do you think that's a good idea?
I think so. The D.C. Republican Party has always stood for budget autonomy, legislative autonomy, and virtually no Republican in D.C. likes it when Congress meddles in district affairs.
Will you lobby
regardless
against
of? We still have to meet as a party, as an executive committee. We just had our elections, but certainly we will probably do some advocacy on the Hill. But look, to be honest with you, this is the fundamental reason why we need to elect Republicans in D.C. is that when you're lobbying Congress, they primarily listen to people who are elected. So I'm happy to work with our locally elected leaders to assist
well,
them in this
process. Well, have our locally elected leaders got off on the wrong foot? Only 3 D.C. officials attended President Trump's inauguration last week. That question has been raised by, among others, the new Loose Lips in City paper, whether snubbing the new president will help or hurt the district. What's your view?
Do
you think they should have been there in greater numbers? They showed up with their families and everything.
Sure.
Was it Bowser, Evans, and who was the third one? I can't even remember.
It was at-large council member Anita Bonds.
Councilmember Bonds. Look, I think if you're a member of the D.C. Council, because it's an inauguration isn't the... it's the inauguration. So it's really an American tradition. It's something that happens every four years. And it transcends the individual who is elected president. And I think especially because of the prime real estate that the Wilson building has, and due to the fact that we are pawns, regardless of who's in power in the presidency or in Congress, I think we need to do whatever it takes to make sure that we're not political pawns going down the road. And I think it is the responsibility of individual council members to attend the inauguration. So I was a little disappointed by that, but not surprised.
Well, the train is going down the track right now.
Mm-hmm.
The Congress, the Republican Congress, is going to maybe try to change the gun laws, maybe try to block paid family leave before it gets started. Block dignity and death.
Death with dignity.
Death with dignity. Abortion, unlike any other place in America. Ban any dollar locally raised or public federal monies from being spent on abortion, where no other jurisdiction in America would face that. It would seem to me it's more than just if the Republican Party in the district wants to grow, it would take more immediate action to get ahead of this curve rather than bemoaning the fact that it's been done after it's done. What bureaucratically do you have to do to tell these Republican members who support small government that they ought to live by their words when it comes to the District of Columbia?
Sure.
I mean, Darrell Issa, I think, is the one who wants to stop death with dignity because he's personally opposed to it, as if that trumps all the people who live here.
Yeah, no, and we would...
And there's no sense of outrage on your part, Patrick.
No, there's a sense of outrage, but there's also a sense of numbness when it comes to, frankly, anything coming out of Congress or the White House, regardless of which party is in power. I think that, again, the best thing that we can do is work with our locally elected leaders. I mean, this is part of our problem.
I was about to say, the D.C. GOP has pledged to work with Mayor Muriel Bowser mm-hmm. and locally elected leaders in building a relationship with the Republican Congress and the new administration in the White House. How will that work? Has the mayor reached out to you? Has the mayor responded to your making this offer?
I haven't.
Or the council?
We haven't sat down and met with the mayor. Certainly I've spoken with staff people. I'll chat with, I'll communicate with some folks probably after this interview. But, this is part of the problem is, so even when I was on the Board of Education, and we would go up there quite a bit to have conversations about policies and budget autonomy, legislative autonomy, voting rights. There was really no interest in, we just kind of had to do it alone. And so we really need to work together, all right? This is a bipartisan problem. It's not a Democratic problem. It's not a statehood green. It's everybody's problem. But it's a Republican problem.
It's the Republican Party in the district.
Mm-hmm.
Is it in favor of statehood, which is the mayor's major goal? What is the policy? Have you had a party policy?
The platform is for full voting rights.
Full voting rights. So they have House and Senate or just House?
It's House and Senate, though it's unlikely that that would happen.
Okay. The GOP in general, in nationwide, won big in November, but it was also what your website's boast says, the most successful election mm-hmm. cycle in the district for more than a decade. What do you mean by that?
And for district Republicans.
Right.
So
what went right for the local
27,000 registered district Republicans?
Sure. We had just never really had
Are they all fake ones? Are there voting fraud in the Republican precincts of Georgetown?
That's
I'm going to check.
Whatever it takes. But seriously, though, this election cycle was interesting because we had never run a methodical process where we started 2 years out and really looked at what can we win. Who do we need to recruit? And so we spoke with about 50 candidates. Some would run for ANC, some State Board of Education. One ended up running for DC Council. But frankly, we didn't want to spread ourselves too thin. This is something that happened in the past. And if you look back literally by the numbers, we did increase the number of elected ANC commissioners who happen to be registered Republicans. That's up by 30%.
30% means how many numerically?
Numerically, I would have to get back to you, but it's not a, it's a, we're looking, it's like five or six.
Right.
But for us, that's huge. As a percentage, and we just have to continue that momentum going forward. Ashley Carter was elected citywide to the D.C. State Board of Education.
We had her on this broadcast.
So
you can check in our archives.
Kind of a big deal because it is a citywide, even while nonpartisan, it's citywide, and obviously for most of the, at least the last month of the campaign, the Republican aspect of her life was the most widely discussed aspect. And then finally, Carolina Selnick outperformed by vote totals, every Republican but two who ran in 2008 in the last 12 years. And so for us, this was, by the numbers, the most successful cycle in 12 years. And I think if you look at the fact that it was a presidential, typically in the presidential cycle, it's a very difficult time because if you're a Republican running in D.C., ANC commissioner, Board of Ed, D.C. Council, the first thing they're going to ask you about is the nominee. And obviously, looking at the vote totals in D.C. with President Trump, he was less popular among Democrats and independents in D.C. and therefore his
4% of the vote.
This was possibly the worst cycle to ever run in as a Republican, but we were able to still, by the numbers, eke out some good wins.
You have run for office before. Do you anticipate, or do you leave it open that you'll run for something in 2018?
I could run down the road, but I have a 3-year-old and an 11-month-old, and I know even when I was on the D.C. State Board of Education, you're doing a lot of talking to even at nursing homes, schools, things on weekends, late nights, and that's just something.
It's a commitment.
Yeah, my wife would actually possibly kill me if I did that.
Patrick Mara is the executive director of the D.C. Republican Party. He joins us in studio. If you have questions or comments for him, give us a call at 800-433-8850. Go to our website, kojoshow.org. Watch the live video stream and ask a question or make a comment there. Let's talk about a few issues. You've said the D.C. Council sees the district as a social laboratory, including on issues like paid family leave and minimum wage increases. What are your concerns from a more conservative perspective?
So, again, part of the problem is if you look at the, for example, the paid family leave legislation, I mean, that's the most generous package in the United States that's passed to date. Most of the benefits, so two-thirds, somewhere around two-thirds, so let's just say something over 60% of the benefits go to residents of Maryland.
64%.
64% go to residents of Maryland and Virginia. And most of the weight of the benefits, the tax, is placed on businesses and small businesses in the district. And so, I mean, the interesting thing here is that, once again, it's these larger businesses like Walmart and Target that can easily absorb these costs. CVS might be another one. These businesses can absorb these costs, whereas the smaller neighborhood business, the family business that may not be selling the $8 beer, it's very difficult for those businesses to stay in business. And particularly when you look at parts of the city and, you know, just focusing on parts of the city where there's food deserts, parts of the city where there aren't opportunities to have services in your neighborhood. This is another one of those things that discourages a small business owner from opening up in the District of Columbia.
Businesses have threatened to leave, but no one has I've asked for someone to call me and tell me a business that has decided to move to the suburb before opening, has decided to close in the district and move to the suburbs. Are you aware of any business? I mean, we have heard this. We've heard this when minimum wage was broached and other issues. And we just saw in, of course, Montgomery County, Ike Leggett has vetoed the minimum wage increase there, saying that it would really hurt business there. And he's worried about businesses either not coming or moving out. Where is the fiscal impact that you see actually happening?
So,
and I thought the paid family leave had, for the smallest, it has to be a certain number of employees.
Yeah.
And I don't know what that number is, but
But a good example, when we're looking at the city moving forward, I mean, a good example is my street, 11th Street. There were, you know, plenty of smaller businesses there. There was plenty of abandoned property there when I moved in, 14 years ago now. Now there are a lot of restaurant and hospitality businesses. The smaller businesses that had been kind of these family-owned, people who live their businesses have, you know, they've moved on. They couldn't afford to stay open anymore. And so, frankly, as a city, we have to determine, well, what's, you know, when you're looking at a small business, is a small business just some business that sells high-priced items to the new residents who moved here? Or should we have a more diversity of small businesses? So this is part of the problem, is for a smaller business.
There are businesses that could not afford, they say, the taxes or the... moved on? I mean,
well, the one there was a Salvadorian cafe across the street from me, and she moved on because she couldn't afford to operate there anymore. And now, of course, it's and I say this.
Is there a thousand?
Praising the business.
Aren't there like 8,000 businesses
now
or
it's
something?
Bad saint.
Aren't there like something like 8,000 businesses in the city? So you're going to have one or two examples maybe. But I'm just, I think there are 8,000 businesses that would be
sure, but business should be easier to start. You know, we should be encouraging people to start businesses.
That's true.
It's in terms of retaining people. Imagine if Ward 7 and 8 had, you know, a significant number, a critical mass of small businesses. You're going to more or less employ greater numbers of people who live in that community. You're going to be a fixture in the community. You're going to provide services to the community. And we just don't seem to have that now. And what we're doing is eventually we're heading in a direction where the businesses over there will be the higher priced businesses because that's what can afford to stay. I mean, certainly if you're charging big prices for your items, yeah, you can absorb those costs. So this cost will be passed on to all of us.
We're running out of time, but I wanted to raise the issue of the federal hiring freeze. That's one of President Trump's priorities. Some say it could have a very negative effect on the district and its economy. What are you concerned about that?
I think, quite frankly, he's been in office only for,
Six days
now. And
Or seven.
I don't think... I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing to put a hiring freeze in place when you're the head of the federal government. Now, if there's still a freeze, you know, 2 years from now, that's a different conversation. But quite frankly, I think they have to do an analysis of, you know, by department to department, and determine what's useful, what's not.
Well, they've frozen grant monies, not just employees, but frozen. Now there,
that doesn't surprise
because
me.
I don't have enough to do. I was reading the president's order on the hiring freeze, and of course he exempted the military, which is mm-hmm. a big deal in this region. We have, particularly for the state of Virginia, and I would assume if it's the military, then military would mean private contracting for military, so that's a big deal. He exempted public safety. Public safety is a broad...
You have 1 minute left.
Okay. Public safety is a broad... It seems to me that this hiring freeze is more politics than it is fact.
Yeah, I think a lot of it depends on how long the hiring freeze is in place. And there was definitely interest in determining how many of these jobs are useful. Are there places we can make reductions? Any president has been in place for 8 years... there is growth in the government.
The fear is that social services, people, employees will be take it in the neck, and the military will grow and grow, and that will not be good for the country or the region. But
well, today is what organizers call and is known as the March for Life, the annual anti-abortion rights event held here in the district. Are you headed now there?
As a party, we don't. It's actually we don't even have the issue in our platform. Since there are so many,
do you have a personal view as a person who's run for public office and might run again? Are you pro-choice or pro-life?
I have said that I am pro-choice. So,
Patrick Mara, he is the executive director of
You'll
the DC Republican Party. Patrick Mara, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for that, Patrick.
Coming up next is U.S. Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland. But as he makes his way here, Tom Sherwood, the Virginia General Assembly has killed a transgender bathroom bill that was introduced by Delegate Robert Marshall of Prince William. And they apparently did it without a great deal of publicity.
That's not unusual.
Yes, they... But he was very upset. He said, you campaign one way and come down here and kill things silently, which is an indication of exactly how it was done. They used an unrecorded voice vote to get rid of that bill. I guess they didn't want to go down the road North Carolina.
Well, our next guest is a veteran of the State House in Maryland and I think in Congress and now in the Senate. But I covered Virginia legislature for a few years in my youth. And killing the bill is an art form. It's done more easily than sticking a knife in someone without them even knowing you've done it. Virginia, all assemblies, the district council in Maryland kill these things. Robert Marshall proposed a bill that has been pure hell for the state of North Carolina, and the Virginia Republicans did not want to go down that road in Richmond.
Well, our next guest is a resident of Montgomery County, even though he is a U.S. Senator from Maryland. So we might try to get him embroiled in another controversy and see if he is able to deal with it diplomatically or if he just
waits. Is this the West Bard Shopping Center?
No, this is the veto by County Executive Ike Leggett of the $15 an hour minimum wage in Montgomery County. Joining us in studio is Chris Van Hollen. He is a U.S. Senator from Maryland. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's great to be with you.
Should Ike Leggett have vetoed this bill?
Look, I am for getting to $15 an hour. I think it's really important, not just in Maryland, but around the country. The question of how you implement that, what the details are the kind of issues that Montgomery County and other local jurisdictions will have to figure out. And obviously, they're trying to figure out an environment where other jurisdictions around them haven't gone to that point yet. But I do think we all need to continue to focus on increasing wages. It's been a big problem, not just in parts of Maryland, but across the country.
Delegate Derek Davis of Prince George's County has proposed a bill that would say that the state of Maryland, the state legislature would set the minimum wage, and the counties, the 24 counties, whatever there are, would not be able to do that in the future. Without getting to the issue of how much the minimum wage should be, do you think the state should take over the minimum wage bill?
I think counties should have the authority to do this. That being said, it's always better if it's done on a broader base. So at the state level and most preferentially at the federal level, many of us have been pushing for years now to increase the federal minimum wage. We've had legislation both to take it to $12.75 an hour and others over time to $15 an hour. Always better if you can do this at the national level, but that doesn't mean that local jurisdictions in the state shouldn't do what they can.
Well, first of all, congratulations on becoming the U.S. Senator from Maryland. My head exploded trying to write down all the issues that we could talk to you today about with the Trump administration.
In that case, I'll take over. You have spoken out.
I'm just wondering, in this whirlwind that we are in now of proposals and semi-proposals and withdrawn proposals and whatever's happening, what is your mood as you go to the Senate knowing that you've got an unpredictable president, even the Republicans say it's unpredictable, and how are you going to map out what you're doing? What are your priorities in this political whirlwind?
Well, that's a really good point. In all the swirl of activity, how do we remain focused on what's most important? And especially now when you've got a president and an administration that makes up, quote, alternative facts and often is living in an alternative universe, not a fact-based universe. My overall goal is, number one, to make sure that this administration cannot turn back the clock on progress in the United States of America, whether it's through its nominees or through its actions. And it's going to be essential that the Senate, especially Senate Democrats, can block bad things from happening, even as we look for some opportunities to do some positive things. The most possible of those would be modernizing our national infrastructure. And I joined with many of my colleagues just this week in putting forward a $1 trillion
plan for infrastructure, a roadmap for President Trump's promised $1 trillion investment in infrastructure. You were about to explain.
Well, and this is really important because this is one area that, you know, President Trump mentioned the very night of the election. It's the only issue he mentioned that night, which is why it's so troubling to see them, you know, marching off to try to repeal the Affordable Care Act and do all these other things instead of focus on one issue that can bring us together. That's a $1 trillion investment in roads, bridges, transitways, expanding broadband. I mean, look in our area. In addition to Metro and trying to do the Purple Line, you've got I-270. It's a parking lot in Western Maryland. You've got I-81. Maryland has huge infrastructure needs, and those mirror the country. And broadband and clean energy infrastructure, those are also real priorities. So this is a great opportunity, right, to expand economic growth with good-paying jobs. Let's start with something like this. And that's why we challenged President Trump to meet with us and get this done.
I feel like I'm being too nice here by saying this, but it's true. You have a reputation for working across the aisle. Of going around political rhetoric to get things done. Have you, in your short time that you've been up on the Hill since your November 8th election, have you talked to Republicans privately who are saying, let's try to work things out, let's get together on things beyond the infrastructure, because everybody likes to spend money, and it's desperately needed, so that's a win-win there, except for the national budget deficit. Are you getting politically a sense on Capitol Hill that the House Speaker Ryan and Mike Pence, even as vice president, who you worked with, are going to be a leavening effect on President Trump's, you know, pinball action as he bounces around from one issue to another, what things he's going to do? Is there going to be any kind of measured response on Capitol Hill that you can discern from Republicans now?
So the short answer is yes, I've reached out to some Republicans on the Hill and had conversations primarily around this really bad idea of trying to destroy the Affordable Care Act and pretend that they've got some replacement. This is going to hurt Americans, regardless of their political party, in every part of the state. It's going to hurt a lot of people who voted for Donald Trump, who may not have understood that they were benefiting from the Affordable Care Act. And I can tell you, Tom, that there are lots of Republicans that realize that, you know, reality is catching up with the rhetoric, because for 8 years they've talked about repeal and replace with never coming up with a replace. And now they're realizing rural hospitals in rural parts of the country are going to get slammed if you repeal the Affordable Care Act.
And the Maryland health care system, I was reading this week, also has everywhere faces this.
Maryland will be really badly hit. It's really out.
If Medicaid expansion is rolled back in Maryland, what will that mean in terms of access to care and in terms of costs?
Well, Maryland will right off the bat lose over $1.2 billion. You've got 400,000 Marylanders who have now signed up either for affordable care through the exchanges or extended Medicaid. And here's the other point to emphasize. Just about everybody is somehow benefiting from the Affordable Care Act. Even if you're on your private employer plan, which is where most Marylanders and most people are, you're benefiting from those patient protections. You can't be discriminated against today because you have asthma or diabetes. You have, you know, you have, we got rid of the lifetime cap so that if you're sick when you need it most, your insurance hasn't run out. Those protections now apply to all Americans. So people are waking up to the fact that destroying this would be really bad for the country. Yes, it can be improved, and many of us have put forward ideas to do that.
Well, the Republicans just got through talking in Philadelphia about what their plans are going to be. Have you been able to talk with any Republicans about what you can get together on to replace the Affordable Care Act?
Well, Kodjo, I've not seen any plan that one Republicans and the Republican leadership agree on that would begin to address all the health needs that are right now supported
remember
by the Affordable Care
a certain
Act. So the answer is they're all worried about it because they know right now they don't have a plan.
I remember a certain member of high-ranking member of the House of Representatives from Maryland who thought he would serve the public by getting together and figure out a way to save Social Security, and then you were beaten to death almost by that with a baseball bat for doing it. So there's some political danger in going out and trying to make compromise with people who want maybe to destroy things.
Well, let me be clear on the Affordable Care Act. This is the problem with the Republican position, the position Trump set. There are things we can do to fix it. There are things you can do to improve it. But you don't improve it by blowing it up and destroying it and then say, oh, well, let's figure out how to pick up the pieces. It's like, you know, your house has a leaky pipe. And instead of fixing the pipe, you say, hey, Tom, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to blow up this house and just I'm going to promise you're going to get a lot better house when this is all done with. And you wouldn't go for that.
You're on the Appropriations Committee and you're going to be on the Senate Banking, Agriculture and Budget Committees. You're going to be in the thick of this.
I'm going to be in the middle of a lot of things, and I'm looking forward to that. And again, trying to make sure that we don't allow this new administration to do a lot of the bad things that talked about while looking for chances to help this region. The Appropriations Committee, of course, allocates federal resources. Senator Mikulski was on that committee. Looking forward to it. I'm the first Maryland senator since 1923 to be on the Ag Committee. So for rural parts of our state, that should be important. And banking, of course, deals with transit. It deals with housing and all sorts of consumer protection issues.
A lot of people want to get in on this conversation with U.S. Senator from Maryland, Chris Van Hollen. He's a Democrat. If you'd like to be one of those, call 800-433-8850. Send email to kodjo@wamu.org. Shoot us a tweet at Kodjo Show. Before I go to the phones, you have spoken out about Congress meddling in affairs of the District of Columbia, including targeting abortion funding, status as a sanctuary city, death with dignity, gun laws. You've promised to fight every piece of legislation aimed at the district. What are you and other Democrats planning to do?
Well, we're planning to use our power, which obviously is not the power of the majority, but in the Senate, you do have the ability to work to stop bad things from happening. Sometimes that's slowing it down. Sometimes that's stopping it altogether. And it's so hypocritical and absolutely outrageous that you've got all these Republicans who say they care about local government and local control, treating the District of Columbia and the people of the District of Columbia like it's their private fiefdom, like it's their little playground where they get to mess around with decisions that have been made by the democratically elected representatives of the district. It's outrageous. We'll continue to fight on behalf of the people of the district who do not have a voice in the Congress today.
What do you recommend the district leaders? Mayor Bowser has stood up for sanctuary cities. It's essentially sticking her thumb in the eye of the president. She has stood for statehood, wants the Congress to deal with that. There's no real anticipation that's going to be an issue soon. What is the, and the Metro has hired Tom Davis, former Republican congressman from Virginia, to help guide them on the Hill as far as Metro funding is. What should be the district's policy? They want to fight back on sanctuary cities. I don't know what the city can do. It's heavily Democratic, and there's a Republican House and Senate. What do you recommend if you were talking to the mayor instead of me? What would you say in terms of how aggressive do you want to be on issues like sanctuary cities and other things?
Well, the issue of so-called sanctuary cities are, you know, same issues are being confronted in other parts of the country as well. I think it's really important when we're talking about that issue in particular that people recognize that local law enforcement believes that public safety is improved when they don't go around acting as federal immigration agents. Because when someone commits a crime in a community, you want everybody to be able to come forth and provide evidence. You don't want someone to worry that if they're a witness to a crime and have nothing to do with it, that they can't go to the police because they're afraid of being deported from the country. So that's why the police in this area have primarily said, we're not going to become federal immigration agents. So this is a broader issue in the country. No one really knows exactly what this new Trump executive order does with respect to its scope, but it is not in support of public safety, according to our own law enforcement.
In the hiring freeze. Can we get to the hiring freeze before we go to the call?
No way. We got to get Joseph and Chevy Chase,
all right,
Maryland.
Can I just briefly say on Metro, though, this is going to be really important because I worked very closely with Tom Davis back when we first got the allocation. $150 million a year of federal funds comes into Metro. It's the only Metro system in the country that gets the special allocation. For 10 years, we got about 2 years left on that. It's going to be really important that our nation's Metro, our nation's subway, gets that continuing support.
Here's Joseph in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Joseph, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. First, Senator Van Hollen, congratulations for being elevated to the Senate.
Thank you.
The Senate has a more substantial role in foreign policy than the House of Representatives, and we have the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom here, and she is talking up this quote-unquote special relationship the United Kingdom has with the United States. I see some disturbing things. I see the United Kingdom leaving the European Union and doing so on the basis of some real xenophobia. The voters saying that they've lost control of their borders.
I don't have a lot of time, Joseph. You've got to get to a question.
Is it time to question the special relationship we have with the UK based on its leaving the European Union?
Senator Van Hollen.
So first, let me say I'm looking forward to getting even more involved in foreign policy issues. My father was in the Foreign Service, a career Foreign Service officer. My mother, very involved in foreign policy issues. Back in the day, I worked for Senator Mathias, moderate Republican from Maryland,
Charles
long before
Matt
I thought I was
Mathias.
Running. He was on the Foreign Relations Committee. I worked on those issues. So I'm looking forward to getting these issues. No, I do not think we should reexamine our special relationship with the UK, but you raise a very real concern, which is we should not sort of in maintaining that special relationship, we should not be perceived in any way at thumbing our nose at the rest of Europe. Obviously, Trump was a big supporter of Brexit. I thought Brexit was a big mistake for the UK. And so whatever we do with the UK should not be at cross purposes with continuing to encourage cooperation in Europe. And it's going to be really important that we maintain a strong NATO alliance, despite the really troubling things that President Trump said on the campaign trail.
No, President Trump's orientation is to move away from NATO.
It has been.
Well, that was one day. We don't know where he is now.
Well, it's been very troubling because it represents a gross ignorance about the important role that NATO has played in our collective security.
Your colleague, Ben Cardin, senator from Maryland, said on the Morning Joe program this morning on CNBC that it was, quote, dangerous for what Trump is doing with Mexico.
Well, getting into a trade war with one of our biggest trading partners is a huge mistake for the country and for American consumers and American workers. And this is another example of where, you know, you can be the CEO of the Trump enterprise and you can bully your subcontractors. But when you go around trying to tell the president of Mexico,
sovereign nation,
that they're going to pay for a wall, which was all, you know, a big Trump soundbite, you're going to get this response. And so to even escalate further by trying to get into a trade war with Mexico is a big mistake. That doesn't mean that we can't look at ways to strengthen NAFTA. I have some significant concerns with portions of NAFTA as well, but this is not the way to do it.
Gentlemen, we have all of 6 minutes left in this conversation.
We've got to talk about federal workers.
Go hiring freeze.
I read the hiring freeze. It's the Swiss cheese freeze. No defense workers. That means no defense workers or contractors. Public safety, and I think public health is mentioned in there. That's a pretty big X. And it also says the Office of Personnel Management can make exemptions to the policy if it feels it's necessary for the safety and protection of the country. But what does it mean for this region as you look out over the
You have said that it could have unintended consequences.
Oh, absolutely. Look, this is just it's a really short-sighted way, obviously, to try to deal with personnel policy.
Lots of presidents have done it, though, coming into the office.
Well, some other Republican presidents primarily, but others have. But the issue here, let's first go to the impact on American citizens. If you're a veteran in a veterans hospital, you've been having trouble with shortages already and difficulty getting in when you need that health care. This applies to people who work
in veterans hospitals. Doesn't come under military
exemption? No, it does not. Oh. And so, you know, here we have long lines of veterans, and they're saying we're not going to hire somebody even if you need it. Social Security Administration, which is in Maryland. I mean, people need to process people's Social Security benefits. I mean, fewer people means longer waiting time. So this has a real impact on people. Finally, look, there may be some agencies where you want to ultimately reduce the scope of the mission. Let's do that in a targeted way. But there are others where you may want to expand it. And certainly when someone leaves, that they're providing a necessary function, you should be able to get some new blood into the federal
government. We got an email from Sharon. We want Senator Van Hollen to vote no to Trump's nominations and virtually all of his actions. But so far, he's not doing that. Why? You have promised to fight the confirmation of three of the president's cabinet picks. Tell us who you're opposing and on what grounds and respond to Sharon.
Well, actually, I maybe people haven't been focused as much on this, but I voted against the CIA director, Pompeo, because of his prior statements and records. I come out strongly against Jeff Sessions. I think the attorney general is a vitally important position in our government. I'm very worried about him turning back the clock on social justice. I've been clear I'm against Betsy DeVos. She's clearly wants to privatize education when I wanted to make sure that we expand opportunities for public education. Scott Pruitt, filed lawsuits against protecting the Chesapeake Bay, even though he comes from the landlocked state of Oklahoma. Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, I came out against. This is a guy who made it big for himself by becoming a foreclosure king, a foreclosure machine. I can tell you today that I will not support Tom Price's nomination for Health and Human Services. He has been not only the architect of dismantling the Affordable Care Act in a very, very outrageous thing that they did was they stopped advertising for signups for the Affordable Care Act, even though this is the final month. If you look at signups in Maryland, they've actually exceeded last year's. And so denying people information about how they can get more affordable care is really an outrageous thing to do. I have actually been come out against.
You're an obstructionist. You're against everybody.
No, I was, but I will tell you, I did support General Mattis at Secretary of Defense. I think he would be a good counter based on all the testimony to the new president. I did support Governor Haley at the United Nations, although I have concerns about her lack of experience. I thought in that position, she's got developed good relationships. So, look, I'm as troubled as everybody by these nominees, and we have been fighting them.
You once headed the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee.
He's now heading up the Democratic Senatorial
Campaign.
And
now you're doing the Senate. The big issue, the Democrats, this is a politics question. The Democrats are trying to figure out who their leader at the DNC is going to be. And people have said the Democrats have lost ground in cities, counties, and states across the country. And you need to refocus the Democratic Party. What is your role going to be in doing that, obviously, with the Senate campaigns? You've got more Democrats up in 2018 than Republicans. It's your best help, I would think, for Trump to fail the first 2 years.
Well, we if he,
that was an unfair question.
No, it will be good if for him to fail on the part of his agenda that is turning back the clock on social justice. We will fight him there. We would like all of us to succeed together as a country on things like modernizing our infrastructure. When you talk about the Democrats up this time, you're right. We have 25 members of our caucus who are up compared to 8 members of the Republican Senate caucus. 10 of our members who are up in states that Donald Trump won. We've got to be better at campaigning everywhere and listening to everyone. This morning I started at a meeting of people from Mountain, Maryland, Allegheny County and Garrett County, Maryland. I did not win the vote in those western areas, but I'm going to work really hard to listen and to make sure we address real needs there as well as in our urban and suburban
areas. You're down to 1 minute.
Do you support anyone for the DNC, Democratic National Committee chairman?
Now, as the head of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee,
you're not taking a position.
My job is to work with whoever becomes the head of the DNC. We have got some terrific candidates. Obviously, you know Tom Perez well from Maryland, Keith Ellison I work with. But
are you going to help a Democratic candidate run for governor against Larry Hogan next year? He's got big approval ratings.
Yeah, look, here's no candidate, but
you're not going to name any candidate.
But it is really important that the governor speak out loud and clear about the risk of repealing the Affordable Care Act without a replacement. This is a dagger at health care in the state of Maryland. He really needs to step up on this issue. He should be speaking out against some of these nominations like Scott Pruitt, who would really hurt the Chesapeake Bay protection effort, because we all have a stake as Marylanders in what happens.
Chris Van Hollen is a U.S. Senator for Maryland. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's good to be here. Thanks.
Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist with the Current Newspapers. Welcome back from staycation.
I'm happy to be back. I had a great time in the District of Columbia visiting the Smithsonians.
That's it for the show today, but there's always more on our website. Cruise over to kojoshow.org. You can find details about a Kojo in Your Community event that we'll be hosting at the Dorothy Height Library on Benning Road in Northeast Washington on February 8th. We're going to be talking about the city's homelessness crisis and what it reflects about our community's values, and we'd like for you to come and be a part of it. And if you go to our blog, you can see a primer put together by producer Avery Kleinman on what President Trump's hiring freeze means for federal workers. And don't forget to meet us back here on Monday, when we'll talk with the attorneys general in Maryland and Virginia about how they're trying to curb hate crimes in their respective states. That's at noon on Monday. Until then, have a great weekend, and thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi.
Kojo Nandi Show is produced by Michael Martinez, Ingelisa Schrobsdorf, Ruth Tam, Elizabeth Weinstein, Avery Kleinman, and Taria Rogers. The engineer is Meg Bunting. Cliff Gallagher has been on the phones. Podcasts of all shows and audio archives are available at our website, kojoshow.org.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Nnamdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.